to thank him again for this series that they've asked me to teach on miracles. You see on the title slide, I'm also using the words wonders, works, and signs. There's a number of different words that the Bible uses with regard to miraculous occurrences. But I don't think in 100 years of preaching, I likely would have come up with the idea myself to do an involved and focused study of miracles like we find ourselves now involved in. This being our third lesson today. And I've already found it just profoundly interesting and helpful. I hope you will as well. So I wanted to thank them at the outset. And then since they were not here last week, we're going to do our review for all of those, of course, who weren't. But this is the primary definition that I put up now in the first two classes, and we'll look at it again this morning, from M.G. Easton and a couple of dictionaries that you may find this in. We looked in the first class extensively at the surrounding passage as well as he is defining what a miracle is. But the central part of it here is that a miracle is an event in the external world, so in physical creation, brought about by an immediate agency or the simple volition of God. It is an act of God, operating without the use of means capable of being discerned by the senses. So we can't explain it by any physical laws that we know. We are helpless as human beings to account for this suspension of natural order. But it continues, and designed to authenticate the divine commission of a religious teacher and the truth of his message. This last part you don't find in most people's definitions of miracles as they study Scripture. I think it's profoundly important, so I was delighted to find that definition, and we'll be looking at that again as we go down through this whole series. Last week, I only briefly mentioned this book, When Skeptics Ask, by Norman L. Geisler. He's an outstanding and excellent scholar. I've been reading after him for probably 30 years now. A number of books that he's written. By the way, I was talking to some of you, mentioned that he's also come out with a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Who was that that recommended to me? I forget. I Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. I bought that this week. They were telling me it was pretty good, and so I thought I'd better have a look at that myself. But Norman Geisler, a very famous scholar, not a member of the Lord's Church, but nonetheless a good Bible student. And he suggested in a chapter in this book about defending the faith, When Skeptics Ask, chapter 5 is devoted, it's entitled, The Questions About Miracles. And on page 92 is this quote, Christianity has better evidence, more witnesses, closer to the time of the events than any other religion. Besides this, no religion offers the kind of miracles Christianity can claim. No other religion has the record of specific prophecy or divine deliverance the Bible gives. And no other religion has any miracle that can be compared to the resurrection of Jesus Christ in its grandeur or its testimony. Now, he didn't put the numbers in there, but I've highlighted five things. Better evidence, more witnesses, closer to the time, the kinds of the miracle, and then the resurrection as supreme among them. There is no other religion, brethren, that has anything like even these claims, let alone the evidence to sustain them. Among all religions that the world has ever seen, Christianity is just preeminently and magnificently superior to any other in the proofs that it must be the creation of God, of the true and living God, and not that of Nostradamus of Buddha or Islam or anybody else that has laid claim to having certain powers and abilities. So then we looked at the book of Genesis in the first class, and I singled out the fact that of the nine miracles that you can see in the book of Genesis, three in chapter 7, 11, and 12, the flood, the confusion of the languages, and the plagues on Pharaoh for taking Sarai into his house. And the last three in chapter 19, all of them, where the angels blind the Sodomites, you have the destruction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Gaboim. Lot's wife is turned to salt. These are acts of divine punishment. So, you know, two-thirds in the book of Genesis, when you look at beginnings, are impressing us in the historical record of God's vengeance upon those who will not serve Him. So these destructions and the confusion of languages and plagues that you see demonstrate there is a God. It is the God we know by the name of Yahweh, and the God, therefore, of the Bible, that is the only God, and He is a God that expects obeisance and obedience. We did not discuss this in detail last week, but I wanted to highlight it here this morning as we get deeper into the study now, that of these nine, you'll notice that starting in chapter 12 with the introduction of Abraham, and down through chapter 19 where you have your last miracle in the 50 chapters of the book of Genesis, so you know more than the last half of the book doesn't even deal with any, but these last are all from the time of Abraham, the time of Abraham. This would be no farther back probably than about 2000 BC, 4000 years ago, but then in and throughout the 1900s BC, 20th century BC. So they're concentrated though. We have these miracles, creation being a direct act of God, Enoch's ascension being a direct act of God, the flood being a direct act of God, the confusion of the languages is a direct act of God. All of these did not involve the demonstration of some individual belonging to God and representing God. But as soon as you get to the last part of the book, these last six, the plague on Pharaoh tells you something about Abraham. And all that follows is involving Abraham in one way or another, and of course Lot, his relative, in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So, recognizing that, just observing that, thought I'd put up a timeline here, which, I believe it or not, I've expanded, but a lot of years being covered. So I know it'll be difficult for you to read the dates and whatnot, but you really don't need to. I just want you to see that from the time of creation that Genesis is discussing, which is probably about 6,000 or more years ago, in the creation week, in those acts of creation, in the 6 days of creation, it's really quite a while before you read about any other supernatural act of God demonstrating His power. What's highlighted here are the 365 years of Enoch's life, which is a long time after the creation time. They're putting it down there about 400 to 500 years, and his death coming down, you know, this from 365 to about 3,000, almost 1,000 years then, from the time of creation. And it's a very singular event. How long does it take? It's just an instant. He's gone. But what does that tell you about Enoch? He was a righteous man, and this is not an act of judgment. This is an act of reward on God's part. So there's Enoch, you know, and in spacing out the lengths of these early men's lives, you know, that looks like a big deal on the timeline. That's the length of his life. The event is just that moment at the end. And then, highlighted here, it says the worldwide flood of Noah. Well, again, that's a sole act of God. It is verifying who Noah's representation, relationship to God. But again, we've got a single year of the flood itself that's taking place right there. And there's nobody left but his family to witness this whole thing. There's only eight of them all together. And finally, we come to Abraham at the end of the book. Abraham's going to live 175 years. He's going to live, as they're showing you here, in the 1900s B.C. But brethren, that's it. You've got these four things that are in the book of Genesis spanning a couple of thousand years and then dealing with events that really are very brief, very centered. So it's just kind of curious to notice how prominent then Abraham is in the book. And how far down through time, 2,000 years, before he shows up, and then God is giving us a period of time where a handful, six, of these miracles are taking place. Now then, we came to Moses. and Moses is at least 400, likely 500, could be even more than that, years after Abraham. There's a very noticeable gap, 4 centuries at least. What I'm developing, wanted you to see on the timeline, and we'll be spending time considering in the remainder of this class and as we go on. Are miracles a constant in God's plan? Are there miracles for all peoples and all times in the book of Genesis? No, there are vast reaches of time where God is not doing anything supernatural to demonstrate either the importance of obeying Him or of identifying some representative who is a servant and a revealer and mouthpiece for God. But it's striking when you look at it in a timeline like this. Somehow it gets planted in the people's minds, and we had several slides in the first class that demonstrate it, that people think miracles are for always. That God's always working miracles. All you have to do is be faithful and ask Him for one. He'll give you a miracle. You should believe in miracles for today. Everybody can have them. Well, that wasn't the case in Genesis. And it isn't going to be the case throughout your Bible, Old Testament or New. So in these first two and now the half classes, take note. Miracles are unusual. Well, duh. It's a miracle. But they're unusual not just in their nature, in their power, in their purpose. They are rare and unusual in time, in history. They're not a constant. They appear at momentous occasions. More on that in succeeding classes. So now, last week, we looked at the first part of Exodus, the first 14 chapters of Exodus. We talked about the burning bush, Moses' rod becoming a serpent, Aaron's rod doing exactly the same thing, the 10 plagues, the pillars of cloud and fire, that's sometimes referred to as the Shekinah, which is also found in chapter 14 two times, and then the parting of the Red Sea. That's all that we did last week. All of it, though, with the particular focus on 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So again, those that weren't here, whoever may have been, but as a means of just burying this in our psyches, chapter 10 and the first two verses of 1 Corinthians read like this. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, Paul tells them, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. That is a very fascinating statement, isn't it? A statement that you find nothing about in Genesis, really. You can kind of derive that. But the terminology in the light that it sheds on the miracles of Exodus and Moses is just profound. God in the cloud and in the sea. So in His physical presence of the Shekinah and in the parting of the Red Sea and rescuing them from Pharaoh's armies, is baptizing the people into Moses. Did anybody get wet? Did Moses feel any different when those people got in him? No! Well, how are they baptized into Moses? They were baptized into Moses, immersed into Moses, placed into Moses, in the sense that because of those miracles, Paul wants to argue this, because of those miracles, Moses is set apart and set up and established as the spokesperson for God, as God's chosen leader, as the man that these people need to follow, as somebody whose leadership needs to be obeyed and emulated. They are immersed into Him. They made some sort of transition from outside to inside. And they were entirely engulfed, overwhelmed, submerged. They were baptized. The word means immersed.
into Moses. They were entirely transferred from being apart from Moses into Moses. They got it by means of these miracles that this man is in our time the living representative of God in heaven. So, back to that original definition by M.G. Easton in the various dictionaries, and pulling out just that central part of this definition of miracles, they are designed to authenticate the divine commission of a religious teacher and the truth of his message. Is that not what 1 Corinthians 10 says about Moses? I think so. It separated, demonstrated, this man is above all others as a representative of God. Now, because Moses plays this amazing role in world history, not just Jewish history, there's more in the book of Exodus, and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy as well, all books which were written by Moses. So in these first five books of our Bible, which tell the early history of humankind, and now have given us a period of time in Genesis that speaks of miracles regarding Abraham, you turn the page in the historical chronology to Exodus chapter 1, and from the get-go, Moses now, 400, 500, 600 years later, is set forth like Abraham had been, even much more prominently. So this morning we're going to look at more of these miracles in five books, four which speak of these miracles, and the next one then is in chapter 15. Now this morning, you know, there's too many, and so we're not going to read every single one of these, but the first few and several later, you know, relatively close together and relatively short. So please open your Bibles. I'm not going to be splashing these up on the screen. But come with me to the book of Exodus now, and in chapter 15, look at verses 23, 24, and 25. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah, so which means bitter. And so the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to Yahweh, and Yahweh showed him a tree. He threw it in the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. He said, "If you'll give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments, keep all his statutes, I'll put none of the diseases on you, which I put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." So I should have added that, 23 through 26. Let me move on, you know, in the next and last verse of that chapter. But what's the point in the sweetening of the waters of Marah? It is a miracle. Is it a miracle that is an act of God alone? Now be careful there. What I'm saying is it an act of God? Well, absolutely. But is there not an agent, somebody else involved, some person that God is using and through whom he is manifesting his power? Well, of course there is. There's Moses. God shows Moses a tree. Throw it in the water. Instantly, the waters are now drinkable. Now, how bad they were and what it is, you know, means bitter, we do not know. Whatever had happened to the water, it was absolutely undrinkable. The people would die first. It was poisoned somehow, or in some other manner, you know, it was just so utterly bad that it could not be consumed. And you toss a tree and it fixes it. Now, anybody know of any trees around here that fix a poison well? Well, I don't either. So what does it do? Who does it single out? Moses and God's power. And, of course, saves the people, you know, from the loss of life. Okay, chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. So this is the next chapter. 16, 12, and 13. Lord speaking to Moses, "I've heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am Yahweh your God.
Now, in verse 12, we have a prophecy. We have a statement about what will happen in the future. It's the near future, tonight and tomorrow morning. So, in 13, it came about at evening, quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. Let's put up 14 and 15 while we're just reading. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. And when the layer of dew evaporated, 15, when the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? They didn't know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Now note, Numbers 11 is going to tell you about those same two events. We're not going to be reading them over there. I add it for you here. But this quail covered to 3 meters deep. Two cubits deep. Let's try to get to 3 feet. We've got meters instead. Okay, but they're 3 feet deep in quail. And then there's this manna that's associated with it a few hours later. Magical meat and magical manna, which means what is it? Bread. Is it magic like we think, though? No, magic has an explanation. Magic is when somebody fools you. Magic is when a guy, makes something look like it's supernatural. This actually is. Nothing ever happened like this before or again. Who does it single out? What does it represent? Once again, the people are complaining. The people are unhappy in their service to their God. And who do they bring their complaints to? Who are they mad at? Moses. Then what happens? Prophecy, two miracles, your needs are met, and you better serve me. God singling out Moses again as his representative. Next chapter, you see how we're getting one after the other. In chapter 17, verses 5 and 6, the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. So we're referencing the 10 plagues on Egypt. Behold, I'll stand before you there on the rock at Horeb. You shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. I named this place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? What's it all about? It's the same thing, isn't it? It's a demonstration that God is with the people. Does he have to work a miracle every single day for you to get that message? Well, hopefully not. Is he working miracles every single day? Be careful now. See, that's it. Once the manna starts, when does it fail? It never fails till the end of the wilderness wanderings. Okay? Now, to understand weekly, this is not a failure. He said, you're going to get these days and not that one, so we won't gather on this day. But that's exactly it. He did work a miracle on a daily basis. For how long? 40 years of the wandering. Now, that is highly unusual in biblical, it's without precedent in biblical history. It was also because of the nature of the circumstances. What? Where were the people? How long are they going to be there? How much food is there for what may have been as many as a million people? Well, no. Okay. So, if they're to survive in that environment for that length of time, what's God going to have to do? Present a miracle. So, this miracle is unlike anything else in history. Who does it emphasize is the representative of God? On the morning where that stuff first showed up and they all watered out and said, well, what is it? What did they have been told the night before? Moses is explaining, here's what's going to happen. God is telling him, here's what's going to happen. What is it? It is God among you, sustaining you. And he will sustain you for 40 years. So from that point on, of course, people were just ever faithful. They had no problems recognizing he was the Lord. You got to serve him, you know. You got every morning, you got a testimony, right? Oh, they're still going to be grumbling. They're still going to be unhappy. They'll grumble about that very thing in due time. Let's look at chapter 17 a little bit later, verses 8 through 16. Amalek, so the Amalekites, came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us. Go out. Fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I'll station myself on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did it, you know, the staff that turned into a snake and all that. Joshua did as Moses told him, fought against Amalek. Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So came about, when Moses held his hand up with that famous staff in it, Israel prevailed. When he let his hand down, what happened? Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. They took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar, named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn. The Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So, in this victory, can wars be won by holding a stick high enough? The answer is yes, but only if what? Only if that stick is in the hand of Moses, the mouthpiece of God. Here comes Leviticus now through Deuteronomy. Now finally, we've completed Exodus. All the miracles of Exodus, who are they about? Really, they're about Moses, aren't they? Is Moses' role very unique? Very unique. Go last quite a while, too. And Moses, then, is being identified by God, and ought to be better recognized by the people, but is recognized by the people, nonetheless, for their failures, you know, as God's spokesperson. Now, though, let's look at Leviticus, and the first thing that hits you in Leviticus at chapter 10 is it about Moses. Really not, and yes, kinda. We're not going to read this one because I know it's so familiar to you and I am running out of time. But in Leviticus, those first seven verses of chapter 10, what did Nadab and Abihu do? They substituted something in the worship of God that God had never forbidden. He never told them not to. They just said, let's do it. They just took it on themselves to add something, to change something. They abandoned the pattern. What did it cost them? Their lives. Was their dad allowed to even grieve for them? No. Now that's harsh. But you get crossways with your God, and there will be now in them an example of punishment and an understanding. Who comes first? God or your kin? God or your own ideas about how to worship? God. Nadab and Abihu, Leviticus 10. And now you skip all the way to Numbers. In Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, so come to Numbers, we're going to read several of these. We were in Numbers 11 earlier, and we saw the quail and we saw the manna. I did not mention Numbers 11, 1, and 2 at that time, but obviously in the book of Numbers, as these things are being repeated, we've got a third event in that same chapter, so at the same time frame. And verses 1 and 2, the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of Yahweh. And when Yahweh heard it, his anger was kindled, the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp, and the people therefore cried out to Moses. And Moses prayed to Yahweh, and the fire died out. Now, we looked at a lot of miracles in Exodus. When the fire come down from the Lord was made out of the bayou in chapter 10 of Leviticus. We left that entire book to come to Numbers. Now we have fire from the Lord and another punishment of God upon the people. What do the people do here that is very interesting in the midst of all the stories you've heard about Moses? Are they griping at Moses that he's not leading them properly? What do they do this time? Help us. Okay? Here, they come running to Moses. Moses help. Does he? Indeed. So, does he now once again get the endorsement of God as his lone representative for these people? Obviously, yes. Miriam gets to griping about this position of prominence in the next chapter, chapter 12. Now, again, you know these stories. What happens when Miriam gripes? You take it too much, you think you're better than the rest of us, you know, and all of that. Well, he was. That's exactly what God wanted them to appreciate. But for a sister, that'd be hard. You know, prophet is without honor among his own family. And so they're grumbling against Moses and the Cushite woman that he married, and you know the story. And so immediately, what happens to Miriam? She is punished with leprosy. In Numbers chapter 16, we don't have Miriam anymore, but we sure have another punishment, don't we? Now you can see there's a lot of verses in there, 28 through 50. Actually, it's the entire chapter, that gives you the setup. But if I say Korah, what immediately comes to mind? Okay? Swallowed by the earth. That was also attended by divine punishment in fire and a plague. And in Numbers, please, open to chapter 16 and look on down in Numbers at the very bottom. Just take one of the three plagues in verse 4, or punishments, in verse 49. Those who died by the plague were how many? Numbers 16:49. 14,700 people, besides those who died on account of Korah. Do y'all remember how many died on the account of Korah? It's 250, but I don't see the verse, but it's earlier in that chapter. You've got 250. So add 250 to that, and you're getting awful close to what nice round number? 15,000 people. 15. What did they do that 15,000 people should die spectacularly, horribly? What is it? They griped. That's all it was. They murmured. They whined, and they were unhappy. With whom? Moses, the mouthpiece of God. You complain against God's representatives, and the earth can open up and swallow you. Fire can descend to kill you. A plague can be sent out. Just it will cost 14,700 lives. Numbers chapter 17. So again, the next chapter, they're thick. In chapter 17, verses 1 through 10. Verse 2. Speak to the sons of Israel, get from them a rod from each father's household, 12 rods from all leaders according to their father's household, write each one's name on his rod, write Aaron's name on a rod, one rod for the head of each of the father's households. What are we doing? Who are we picking to be what? A priest. Miraculously, what happens to Aaron's rod? That dead old thing starts to bud. And eventually, it's going to be kept there with the Ark of the Covenant, as a matter of fact. who is chosen by God miraculously to be that first high priest? Aaron, his rod buds. Notice chapter 20, we have another water from the rock story. Let's read all of this one, 7 through 11. Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, assemble the congregation, and speak to the rock before their eyes. What do you remember about the previous time we got rock from a water? What was Moses supposed to do? He's supposed to strike the rock with the rod. Is he told to do that here? What is he told to do here? Speak to the rock, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. It's one of the saddest passages in the entire Bible. Moses will be allowed to view it. He will not be allowed to enter after all he has been through. Why? Old Testament or New, there's a phrase that explains this. God is not a respecter of persons. He is absolutely just. He is absolutely fair. He is absolutely going to treat everybody exactly the same. And if even Moses and Aaron rebel, then what do you learn in this miracle? You're going to pay for that. Now, God needed to save the people. They needed the water or they die. He had to do it to fulfill his later plans for these people. But Moses and Aaron got apparently arrogant, took too much on themselves, didn't honor the Lord, and it will cost them the promised land. Does everybody get the point that you have to serve God and no idol? Well, absolutely. Numbers 21. We're almost finished. Numbers 21, verses 6 through 9. The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. They bit the people so that many people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses. Their awful heart, you know, and a lot of time is passing, brethren, recognize, you know, it is 40 years, and you're raising up new generations of people who would not have been seeing the previous miracles. But every time it's proven. We've sinned because we've spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. Moses interceded for the people. The Lord said, make fiery serpents, set it on a standard, and come about everyone who's bitten. When he looks at it, shall live. Moses made a bronze serpent, set it on a standard, came about every serpent bit any man. When he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. Who is God's representative? Moses. Last one. Balaam's donkey speaks. Everybody's favorite. Balaam's donkey speaks. That's a long passage. Chapter 22, verse 22-35, and even more. So, you know the story. Balaam wanted money for what purpose? Curse God's people to get crossways with God. And a miracle taught him better. And, you know, a donkey told him he was out of line. Now, brethren, here's the conclusion of our class this morning. Racing through these like we have, finishing the first five books of Moses. Who is, there's a couple of rare exceptions, but who is the miracle worker in the first five books of Moses? Moses. And what did the people learn? What Easton said. This is why his definition is so important. He just simply is observing
designed to authenticate the divine commission. So God is most prominent, separated from any other pretender to God's throne. The divine commission of a religious teacher and the truth of his message. We have now finished 5 books in the Bible. And from the timeline, what did you notice? There's miracles in Genesis. There's miracles in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But they're clustered in certain periods of time. They are separated by hundreds of years. Though we've looked at a lot of miracles now, the proper word to describe them is rare. Rare. If we've learned anything up to this point, are miracles for all time? No! Are miracles for everybody to witness? No! God had particular purposes in narrowly defined and focused time frames. More on that in the weeks to come. Thank you. Class dismissed.